I'm going to start with a question this morning for us as a church. Let me explain the question after I state it. What will we, Windsor Baptist Church, do with our dash? So if you've been to a funeral, Grace Cornog's funeral, there was a poem read. I've heard it read many times over the years at funerals, a poem called The Dash. And the idea in the poem is that there's a date on a tombstone, a dash, and another date. The date of birth, the dash, and the date of death. Now, I heard this poem read again on Friday when a woman who lived across the street from us, a Christian woman, and it was evident that she had had a big impact on her family for generations as a Christian woman, by the testimony at her funeral, had died. And her one, I believe it was a granddaughter, read again this poem called The Dash. And in this poem, it says that the dash represents all the time that she spent alive on earth. And it says in there, "For it matters not how much we own, the cars, the house, the cash. What matters is how we live and love and how we spend our dash." Now, typically, this poem is used as a way to take stock and as an individual to think, how am I living my life? What am I doing with my life? I want to ask us, though, as a church, as Windsor Baptist Church, because together we have so much time here, days that are given to us, life that is given to us, and opportunity that is given to us. And as a church, let's ask this question this morning. What will we do with our dash? Some churches attempt great things for God, but too many never really do. Too many churches play it safe. They never step into challenging situations, and they accomplish very little. So you get people that say things like, well, hey, we're not trying to rock any boats. We're just trying to be faithful. Or to the culture around, hey, don't mind us. You know, you see churches, it's very sad. If you go and look at the architecture in most of the cities in our country, you will see small churches surrounded by large developments, and these churches have been swallowed up. And it's a reflection, it seems, very much of the loss of the faithfulness of these churches as witnesses in these cities, being swallowed up by the culture around. But I heard a testimony that contrasts that. And it was a few years ago about a church in New York City. And the man that shared the testimony was an elder at this church and had been since it started. This testimony of the man really stuck with me. He's an elder still at this church that's called Redeemer in New York City. Now, the church started with 15 people praying in Manhattan for an opportunity to witness to the people that were professionals, mostly 20s and 30s, young professionals that were on fast-paced careers and had incredible questions, lots of skepticism about Christianity. So they were praying, and they started inviting a man who was a professor here at Westminster Seminary named Tim Keller. Tim Keller would go there, and he would talk with them and pray with them and discuss. And very quickly, in 1989, he felt the call to go there with them and labor to start a church. So they started this church with 15 people, and they started renting a place to hold services in 1989. The church, they rented a Seventh-day Adventist church. If I understand it right, they would use it on Saturday, and then it was available to rent on Sundays. Very shortly, this church grew, and by the December of that year, they were a church of 250, renting this space in Manhattan. Then things really exploded. Almost the following year, they said they had almost weekly conversions. You can read about the story of their history on Redeemer.com. They went to four services in a place that could hold 400 people, approximately. And that was when this man's testimony happened. Okay, so the church was growing incredibly, and they didn't have enough space, and it seemed that almost like what you would call a revival, because there were so many conversions. And there was so much interest in such a strongly secular setting that all of this was happening in this growth for the gospel. The elders of this church then met and they had a meeting, and they had the opportunity, because a college called Hunter College, their auditorium was available to rent. And I was looking up yesterday to find the seating capacity at Hunter College Auditorium, and I think it's probably a few thousand. And this is the way the conversation went. When they were having this meeting among the elders, they were sitting around and they were talking about whether or not they should invest the money to rent this university's auditorium each week. And there was real trepidation. And most of the conversation, as it does whenever you have a group conversation, it usually tends to go in a certain direction. And it was going in a direction of trepidation, of well, that might be too much. I mean, if we rent this whole big thing, I mean, the place will look so sparse. And we'll have to rope off sections just to keep people in. Well, that was when he explained that at that point, Tim Keller said, "Listen, man," he said, "we have a chance to do something here. God has been with us to this point, and we have an incredible opportunity. What are we going to do with this opportunity?" And that elder says that that was the turning point for him. And he said that when they did that and when they rented this, it just exploded. And so the ministry then just bloomed even more. And what happened then was Redeemer became a church that has, for the last few decades, been planting other churches and strengthening other churches. And it has grown to be a strong, solid biblical witness in New York City and really around the world. They've planted churches in lots of major cities around the world. But there was that one point where they had sort of a crossroads. Are we going to go this way or are we going to go that way? Like I said, some churches will face that, will come to those points where they have opportunity and they will go for attempting great things for God. But too many others choose to play it safe, and they don't. So today, Windsor, as we look at the book of Nehemiah, I want you to think about this one simple question. What will we do with our dash? Here's a quote from an English Baptist missionary named William Carey. William Carey said, "Expect great things from God, attempt great things for God." William Carey was a successful missionary, and you can read about his biography, you can read about it online or in books, and William Carey said that there was nothing special about what I did. I just continued to work at a task and work at a task, and he worked at the task of missions to India. He was called later the father of modern missions and one of the founders of the Baptist Missionary Society. Now, Nehemiah's experience is for us an example of how God uses his people to do great things for his glory. Things that have importance for the rest of eternity. Today's passage in Nehemiah chapter 2 shows that God's people must navigate hateful opposition in the pursuit of God's glory. Let me say that again. The lesson that we want to get from this passage in Nehemiah is this, that God's people in every age must navigate hateful opposition in the pursuit of God's glory. So Nehemiah, as we pick up in verse 9, if you want to take a look at this and have it open, it would be very helpful. This journey to Jerusalem for Nehemiah would have taken about 4 months, but the journey is not mentioned in this narrative. The focus goes immediately to when Nehemiah arrives, just before he gets to Jerusalem, and then when he gets to Jerusalem. So we'll break this into three sections. Nehemiah arrives, that's verses 9 through 11. Nehemiah inspects the wall in 12 through 16. And then Nehemiah calls God's people into action in 17 through 20. First, Nehemiah arrives. Verses 9 through 11. Then I came to the governors of the province Babylon. the province beyond the river. This was actually Persian at the time. Beyond the river, and gave them the king's letters. Now, you can read about the letters back in verse 7, where it says that Nehemiah asked, he said, "If it please the king, let letters be given to me to the governors of the province beyond the river." They had a specific reason for these letters, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah. Okay? He said, "Now, the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly, and someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel." This is what Nehemiah finds when he arrives. Now remember, he's cupbearer to the king, and he sets off on this great journey. He goes from a place where there's incredible security, and there's military might, and he has the favor of the king. And he goes on this journey from, if you consider the place that is today in southwest Iran, he would have traveled a total of about 1,000 miles across the Middle East to get back to Judah. God's people were in great distress in Jerusalem without walls. And the language used in chapters 1 and chapter 2 to describe this indicate that they were subject to abuse. And they were subject to exploitation. They were put in shameful subjection because they were defenseless without walls. Now, Jerusalem had suffered in this condition for about 140 years since the exile, with only limited success of reforming and of reestablishing an identity as a nation there. The Israelites were oppressed for a long time, and they suffered many, many defeats. The way when people go through this for generation after generation, the way that people think becomes affected, and an identity develops. And so with Israel, there was not a heart to pursue great things. Instead, there was lethargy. And there was not vision. And there was not a sense of, we can do this. There was a sense of defeat. I think about Nehemiah arriving in Judah, like when Wyatt Earp showed up was it Dodge City and the shootout at the OK Corral? You know, you have westerns that show scenes like that, where in the Wild West, whoever had more muscle really ran things. Not much changes. When Wyatt Earp showed up and he had the law on his side and he had to face these gangs, then his muscle was enough to face down that muscle. Well, it was kind of like that when Nehemiah arrived. Using that analogy, Nehemiah walks in with muscle and he walks straight in the front door. You see, he has the king's officers and he has horsemen, and it's a display that would have been very impressive. And so they were not opposed. They were not swallowed up by the local muscle. So he had this muscle with him, the officers of the army and the horsemen that were with him. And he had authority with him. Okay, he had authority. It says in this passage, he had letters from the king. So as we saw, these were letters to the governors. Now, there were different letters because he also had a letter that was with it to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest. And I think that Nehemiah kept that tucked nicely inside his jacket because he didn't reveal why he was going to Jerusalem. But he pulled out the other letters and he said, "Gentlemen, I'd like to call you together. We're here, and the king, Artaxerxes, says in this letter, see it right here, you will let us pass safely to Jerusalem." Now, this is a tense scene, because they did not want the welfare of Jerusalem to happen. And what happened was that two of these governors didn't like it. Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite. And Nehemiah, in his memoirs here, flags them. And he says, you can see that these were enemies of Israel. They were upset that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. Great, they were thinking. We've been exploiting them, and now someone has come to help them. We don't like this at all. Let's find a way to stop it. And so from the rest of this book, we will see their attempts to do so. There was a long pattern of oppression and subjugation of God's people, and it was still happening. And Nehemiah would have to face this down, and he would have to face it head on if he would have any hope of success. Friends, if you are going to do anything for God, if you are going to do a work for God's glory, there will be opposition to what you do, and you have to be ready to face some wolves. You have to be ready to fight certain battles that are originating in the spiritual realm, but will come to you in many different ways to oppose you and to keep you in a place of quietness and of not helping God's kingdom advance. Dale Ralph Davis is a commentator, and on verse 10 he says this. He said that a man coming to seek good for the sons of Israel drove them to a diabolical rage, referring to these men who were leaders of these communities, of these smaller nations that were opposing the development and any kind of goodness that would happen with Israel. He said that it drove them to a diabolical rage. And Davis says this, we are not dealing, when we're looking at this text, we are not dealing with mere human animosity. We are dealing here with the serpent's seed hating the seed of the woman. Remember, Israel was the place where God said that I would put my throne forever and I will put a king here and he will be the Messiah. And so Israel and Zion was the hope for Israel that God would place his Messiah that would be the Savior and the light of the whole world and that nations would look to him. And that God's glory was bound up with what was happening with God's people. And for Nehemiah and for those in his generation, they were saying, what we are doing is for God's glory. And there will be enemies. And you can see with the language that they knew very well, we are doing this because God is helping us and we are doing it for God, for the advancement of his kingdom. Now, I want you to not miss this. Verse 11, when Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem, he rests for 3 days. One of these days was probably the Sabbath. Verse 11, just a short comment on this, but it's very important. Nehemiah spends the first 3 days getting rest. A commentator, Raymond Brown, says it this way. Physically exhausted people are not likely to achieve as much as they desire. Tiredness robs us of essential perspective, multiplies anxiety, makes new opportunities intolerably burdensome, and destroys our peace. Sometimes the most spiritual thing and the best thing you can do for God's kingdom is to go to bed at a reasonable hour and to take each week a day of rest and to stop from your labors and resting in Christ. Nehemiah rests for 3 days. It was a long journey. He would have been tired. He would have been worn out. Just like we can be when we travel and we're jet lagged or when we're working on something long hours for a while. So that's how Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem. Secondly, verses 12 through 16, Nehemiah inspects the wall. One thing that we see in this text is that he keeps his big mission a secret. He doesn't tell anyone. You see it in verses 12 and in 16. It says, verse 12, then I arose in the night and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. And then later, he says, verse 16, the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing. And I had not told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. So there were enemies, but even the people that were a part of Israel, he said, I don't really know who I can trust here. And I'm not going to be dangerously chatty with everyone that I meet. I'm going to keep what God has put in my heart, until the right time. He keeps his mission a secret at first. And the people would have been buzzing. this man of great authority shows up with strength, and he shows up with a role to do a job here in Jerusalem, clearly. Just observing him walking into town, everyone would have known something is going to happen. And so there would have been a buzz. But he doesn't tell why. And at night, when there wouldn't have been the observation of what he's doing, he inspects the wall. If you ever want to do something, and you want to do it when no one is around, get up at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. and go out. And the land is quiet. Inspecting the wall, then, was his job that night. And it was with a few others. And they didn't know what he was doing. But these were probably men who knew the wall and where you could pass and how to get around. So he does it at night when there wouldn't be speculation about what he was doing there in Jerusalem. And his journey takes him, if you read the names of this, basically he takes him around. So he's weaving in and out, looking at the wall around the southern edges of the walls of Jerusalem. So Nehemiah inspects the wall and he makes a plan, and then he seeks to muster support after that. Because Nehemiah needed agreement. He needed a common heart to do this work for God and for God's people. He didn't know those whom he could trust. He didn't know who they were. And Nehemiah came to do a great work. He came with a job to do, even knowing that there must be incredible suspicion about him. What does he intend to do here? Why has he come here? What is he all about? You know, sometimes when things change and there's new leadership, when there's change, people think, I'm not sure I'm going to like this. And there's a lot of hesitancy. There is trepidation. There's fear. Because the status quo, we've gotten used to it. We know how to function with the way things are. But what if this guy that's showing up, what does he want to do? Does this have to do with the wall? I mean, everyone knows we don't have a wall. Well, what if he does build the wall? Is he going to build a wall and then leave? And then we're going to have to deal with the problems after he's gone? And so Nehemiah kept this quiet. People wondering maybe, what would this cost me? Nehemiah, it says, kept God's call in his heart. He didn't tip his hand. So then we get to where Nehemiah calls God's people into action. Verses 17 through 20. Here is the argument Nehemiah makes. It's in three, maybe you could argue 4 points. First, he says, listen, everybody. He calls them together. We are God's people. Second, he says, we are in shame. We're in trouble and derision. And he says, this is the heart of the problem. And then he says, but listen to this. God has been with me. The king gave me these words. He's provided provision. The God's hand is on this. And the last part of his argument actually doesn't even come from him. It comes from the people when they say, let's get up and build. And all of a sudden, God brought their hearts together and they were ready to do this thing for God. Let's look at those 4 things. First, he says, we are God's people. Verse 17, then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in. He identifies this man that has seen Jerusalem now for a few days, the first time in his life. He says, I am a Jew. I am one of God's people, an Israelite. And so are you. And we have a big problem here. He identifies with them. He doesn't come in and say, you know, you guys have a big problem. Let me fix it for you before I leave town. But he says this. This is the heart of his argument then. He says, we are in trouble and derision. Now, the idea with these words is that they were under evil. They were experiencing evil doing from the hands of others. And that they were being exploited over and over again. And he says, that is wrong. It ought not to be that way. And that is the heart of our problem. And it's reflected because of this wall. And the solution to this defenselessness and being exploited all the time is to fix our wall. You see, we are exploited. We are under this evil treatment because we have no defense, because we don't have a wall. And then he says in verse 18, God is with me. I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also the words that the king had spoken to me. Now, these people, many of them would have remembered how the king stopped their efforts before to build a wall, and how recently the wall had been torn down and the gates burned again with fire. So if the king's heart had been turned, then maybe God's hand really was with us. And these people are thinking, wait a second. The king authorized this. The king sent you to do this. So God's hand is with you. God's hand has opened up this opportunity. It says in Psalm 127, in fact, Psalm 127, the whole way through, we read it last night before bedtime. There are a lot of parallels with the things that are happening in the book of Nehemiah with Psalm 127. But just read the first two verses. I am certain that Nehemiah knew these because he knew the Bible so well. Familiar words to us. Psalm 127, first couple verses. Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord, Yahweh, watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. He said, God's hand is with us. God, he says, the hand of my God was on me for good. And so if God is with us, who can be against us? That's the promise that Paul points us to in Romans chapter 8. What can separate us from that keeping love of God? And the answer is, it doesn't matter what opposition we face. It doesn't matter what we face, even to the point of death. God's keeping love will keep his people. And the people heard something of this with Nehemiah's words, that the hand of God was with us. And they said, let's get up and build. That's what they said. Let us rise up and build. And they presented the argument to Nehemiah. He didn't even have to go to the fourth point in his outline. So you have people here, and observe this, that people can learn to live with a sense of inferiority. People can learn to live with a sense of shame and of brokenness. Windsor, remember, my big question for us this morning is, what will we do with our dash? And I want you to think about this. We are living in a time where secularism is rising and where Christianity is less and less welcomed in our world, in our workplaces, in media. And how will we respond? Are we going to become more quiet and shrink back? Are we going to say, I don't want to rock the boat? Or are we going to be out there and in this world, and are we going to be attempting things that are great with eternal significance for his kingdom? We must not learn to live with a sense of inferiority, shame, brokenness. As Christians, we are children of the great king. Nehemiah had to overcome something in Israel. He had to overcome this brokenness. He had to overcome the fears of going for something great. He had to overcome the fears of building a wall again. Nehemiah had to muster a hope of turning from the familiar shame that they had known into a sense of safety, a sense of going for it, and of a hope of dignity of what was yet to come. Nehemiah had to get his brothers and sisters to overcome their trepidation, their fear, by stirring up a willingness to try and to go for it. And they did. You know what happened as soon as they did? As soon as they began this effort, as soon as it became known. And so there's the first glimpse that there were people that were opposing them from within Israel, from within Jerusalem. As soon as they began to build, opposition came right away. in verses 19 and 20. Verse 19, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? It's this slanderous sort of speculation. And probably because Nehemiah came with military forces, that's probably what protected them at this stage from being attacked again, and what kept them only insulting them and jeering at them. And he replied to them, and he said, I replied to them, the God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. Now, it's interesting that just like Paul speaks about the opposition to his building the churches, and he told Timothy, he would say, there's a guy in that town, his name's Alexander the coppersmith. Beware of him. He did me great harm. He will oppose you. Okay? And he named names. And right here, Nehemiah is naming names. He says, Tobiah, Sanballat, and Geshem. These are big, powerful men. They were opposing us. Now, if this project was to have success, the people had to come together. And unifying people is no small task. God's hand has to be on it. People have to have the same passion and common desires to cooperate in any endeavor. And the church is the same. We have a great work to do, and we need one another in the work that Christ has given us. Our work is to build his kingdom. And just like with the children's sermon, I want you to think about this. When Jesus decided to build his kingdom, he sends his followers in weakness. He sends sheep out among wolves. He calls us to count the cost. He calls us to take up our cross. In other words, to choose to suffer and to risk for the sake of his name. For the sake of this message of the cross and of the resurrection, of the hope of his kingdom. And he calls us to follow him. I met a man this week who I referenced him in Sunday school. He was influenced by another man who was a missionary in Korea. After the Korean War, there was an incredible opportunity for missionaries to get into South Korea. And this one man who was a missions professor influenced the man that I had lunch with. And this missions professor went to Korea, and he was in Seoul. And he decided, I'm going to reach out to the prostitutes with the gospel. Now, when he did this, he faced incredible opposition. When I was in the Philippines, I was good friends with some people who were doing the same thing in Manila. When you go and you try to reach a community that has been subjected to abuse and are being exploited, those who are exploiting them will resist you. When this man was in Seoul, he would get beaten up regularly. And one time, they dragged him into an alleyway where it was dark, and they put a board between his legs, and they broke his ankles. And this man kept going back to these prostitutes with the hope of the gospel. Incredibly, this missionary effort that was a few generations ago has resulted in an incredible witness in the church. And the presence of Christianity in South Korea is very strong. And so much that the seminary where I went was probably maybe 15% came from South Korea or were second generation children of those from Korean churches that were at my seminary. And today I think it's like 25-30% up at Gordon-Conwell. Anyway, this man told the man that I had lunch with about the opposition that was faced. And he talked to him and he said, you know, one people group in this country that really needs the gospel, this is back in the 80s, he said, are the gay and lesbian communities, because no one is going after them from the church, and if they ever seek to explore a church, they are not welcomed, and the churches don't want to deal with their problems and with their sin. And so he started a ministry, and as you probably know,
By the way, Tim Keller was there, a part of that ministry, and Tim Keller encouraged him to do this because there's a what's called a Gaberhood near 10th Presbyterian Church in Philly. And this man, John, started this ministry called Harvest, John Freeman. And so he was the founder of Harvest USA, and that's one of the ministries that we support as a church, and I'm glad that we do. So it grow, and the big mission of that ministry is to create what they call sexually healthy churches. So they deal with the problems of like pornography and homosexuality and different things like that. When you attempt great things for God, you will face a fight. It will happen. The origins are the same. The devil hates Christ and his church, and he will fight against it. Enemies will be without and within. Jesus said this. Jesus said, listen, nobody enters a strong man's house unless he first binds the strong man. Okay, so if we are Christians, we're looking around at us and saying, okay, there will be opposition. And Jesus is saying, the evil one has a certain kind of dominion and he has control that opposes the church. And if the church is going to advance against that, that strong man has to be first bound. Well, Colossians 2, 14 and 15 tell us that Christians have been made alive by the canceling of our debt when Jesus nailed it to the cross. And when he did this, when Jesus died on that cross, he disarmed the rulers and authorities. That's the evil that opposes the advancement of the kingdom through his church. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame. See, the cross is the Lamb of God who sends out his followers as sheep among wolves. And in weakness, he overcame all of the evil opposition and this dominion of darkness, which is the devil's. This is how Jesus can tell his followers. He can say, in this world, you will have trouble. It's going to happen. But take heart, I have overcome the world. In other words, I'm going to make things happen, and you're going to go in, and some of you will die, but some of you will have success. Some of you will be swallowed up with evil, but if you're going for it, some of your endeavors are going to succeed because I will build my church. And what Jesus said is that the gates of hell will not stand against it. When he said, I will build my church, now think about that. The gates of hell, that's a defensive posture. So Satan, you know, this dominion of darkness is trying to defend against our attacking it. But he said that those gates can't win against the advance of the church. And this is how we can attempt great things for God, how we can similarly go for it. So friends, here's what it comes down to. We're asking, what will we do with our dash? It is okay if we go for it and we get swallowed up by our enemies, if we die trying. It is okay to seek to get traction and to make eternally significant things happen if we end up spinning our wheels, if God sees fit for us to finish in that way. Think about Stephen, the first martyr, a man that was full of the Holy Spirit, witnessing in the early church, and he died so young. Well, God allowed that to happen, and God had purposes for that. And that might happen to us as a church. And it's okay to go for it if we end in that way. I mean, it's okay to end in that way as long as we're going for it. And it's okay for a church to sow attempting great things, in the words of William Carey, if God sees fit to let it yield only a very small crop. That belongs to him. But it is not okay to not even try. It is not okay to cower and hold back when God puts before us opportunities for the advancement of his kingdom. It is not okay to not go for it. If we do, we will be like the servant who buries his talent. It is not okay to bury our talent. It is not okay to ignore the opportunities that we have because of opposition, because of our trepidation, when we have the opportunity and the command to make disciples and to build his kingdom. So here is our application. When we think about this, dash, we have to go for it. We have to go for it. Just like Keller said to his elders, friends, we get one shot at this. And then we've got all eternity to live with it and to remember. We have the opportunity to go for it. Let's go for it. Look around us. Look around where we're living. This area is booming with growth. There are houses being built, businesses, developments all around us. And we are here by God's sovereign appointment. And we have opportunity to be a strong witness in this area. And God has already established us with a foundation for witnessing to this area. We have two very fruitful ministries here. You know what I'm going to say? Hear me out. The preschool and the academy. You know what happens every year in these ministries? The teachers are teaching children the gospel day after day. And they're going home and they're reading their children's Bibles. And increasingly, we have an increasing number of people that are not Christians coming into our schools. And I love that. You know what happens? These children sing songs about Jesus in their homes. And then the parents, whose hearts are connected to their children, hear this and they say, I need to get into church. And people come to Christ in that way. And you know what else happens? There will be play dates that are happening. They're happening right now, where new families are coming in and there are children in certain grades. And other families say, okay, we've got an email list. Who wants to meet at the playground for a play date? Or let's go to my pool. Or whatever it is. And there are play dates that are happening right now. And some of these families are Christians and some of them are not. But because Windsor is here, because these ministries are here operating, we are creating opportunities where these people that don't know the gospel and they don't know the hope of Christ are being invited and told, you know, why don't you come with me to church sometime? Or we have a Bible study at our house. And you know, in this area, if you look at churches around us, there are hundreds and hundreds of families who have come to Christ and have connected with good churches because of these ministries right here. Get to know these ministries. Get to know what's happening. Pray for them. This is how we get to go for it. Pray for the success. This week we'll be meeting with teachers for in-services with both schools. We can expect great things of God and attempt great things for God. And we have an incredible door of opportunity that is right before us. The fields, like Jesus said, are white for harvest. So my only question to you this morning is this. Windsor Baptist Church, what will we do with our dash? Let's pray.